And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Green light 3-0 and she's gone!
Welcome to the 3-0 Show, part of The Athletic Baseball Show. It's Monday, October 30th. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. Bridger only off again this week, but, you know, working. Of course, because it's the World Series, and it's been a great World Series so far, especially Game 1, you know, the on-deck crew. Steven and Levi talked about it a lot earlier in the day on this feed, but as I think about playoff games in my lifetime, this one actually does rank at or near the top of the list in terms of drama and just overall excitement.
Yeah, it was a really exciting game. That was a great introduction to this series. And I think one thing that I was worried about was, you know, my prognostication going in was that, like, this Rangers lineup would be the differentiator, because we've got, I think, some staffs that kind of have some strengths and flaws that line up pretty well with each other in terms of pitching, in terms of defense. There's a great piece today about from Levi Weaver about how the Rangers have gotten much better at defense year over year. Nate Lowe specifically, but a lot of them. Corey Seager's defense has been better this year. And then D-backs are, I think, consensus one or two best defensive team in the majors. So you've got some pretty good defensive squads. And I thought this lineup of the Rangers would be such a differentiator. So I was really watching to see how much offense the D-backs would show. And, you know, now in hindsight, like, oh, well, they scored 9 in the second, but like in the first one, I was like, oh, like, is this going to be like a 4-0, you know, type series? But the D-backs offense came through, and, you know, credit to all their hitters. Like, it wasn't just one or two hitters. It's been a deeper lineup than I thought. I thought the bottom third of this lineup would be really terrible, and it hasn't really been the case so far.
Yeah, I mean, you just think about the way the end of Game 1 played out, right? You get the situation the way you want it. We've talked about some concerns about this Diamondbacks bullpen over the course of the season. I think we've seen in the playoffs they've got a little more depth than people gave them credit for. Some of that's getting some guys healthy and calling up younger guys like Salfranc and just like mixing and matching in different ways. They've done that really well to get to this point. To get to the ninth inning of Game 1 with a 2-run lead and to have your best reliever, Paul Sewald, out there in a spot where you think you can just close it out. This has gone to script. This is great. We're going to steal Game 1, only to have Corey Seager hit just a moonshot home run. That was a huge, huge moment, because aside from, you know, the eventual Adolis Garcia game-winning home run in the 10th, you start to wonder, like, oh, is this going to have any sort of carryover effect into Game 2? Like, you had everything you wanted, and it didn't go well. And the answer was a resounding no. I mean, the Diamondbacks pounded out 16 hits in Game 2. They had a hard hit rate above 50% as a team, which is just impressive through and through. And then some of that was piling some runs on late against Martin Perez. But to just come back to the yard the next day and really brush it off, to even the series at 1, bringing it back to Arizona, says a lot about this team having a short memory and the ability to just turn around quickly.
Yeah, and, you know, a couple key players at the bottom of that lineup. I mean, one is one that you liked before the season, and I didn't. Give you some flowers for Geraldo Perdomo. I just didn't see it because if I have a bias, it's towards hitters that hit the ball hard, and Perdomo doesn't really do that.
He does not
but he
confirmed,
but he controls the strike zone really well, and he makes contact, and that's something that actually the statistics have proven, that contact plays up against better stuff. So as stuff increases, your bat to ball ability and your ability to control for the strike zone, it becomes more important. And I don't know exactly why that is. I think maybe you're just battling if it's against like top end stuff, you're just battling, you're just trying to put that bat on ball, and your ability to put that bat on ball, you know, increases. Maybe also high stuff guys can just strike out guys that don't have good bat to ball, you know? And so, putting that lottery ticket out there, but whatever it is, Perdomo has been, I think, pretty huge to this lineup. He's hitting 400, 500, 400 so far, in this short series. But also Tommy Pham, has put together a lot of good at bats. You know, he had that four hits in game two, even though he had the toot blonde. If anybody knows what a toot blonde is, it's, thrown out on the bases like a nincompoop. is what that stands for. And he got caught by the inside move at second base, just wandering off the bag. But otherwise, he's been really good at the bottom of the lineup. And they've all made up for the only one that really hasn't hit so far this whole postseason is Christian Walker. And that they've done all this without Christian Walker gives me hope that, like, this is going to be a tight series and Walker's going to wake up eventually. And it's going to be a little back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, I think aside from Perdomo doing more than expected throughout the regular season and showing up in the playoffs as your nine hitter, that's kind of nice. Alec Thomas is another guy that hasn't consistently had the underlying metrics that a lot of us were hoping for, but he's showing some signs in the postseason that maybe there is still a little bit more that we can project on. Obviously a great defensive center fielder that always paves the way for a lot of playing time. Kind of look at the big picture, Gabby Moreno is excellent. He, as long as he doesn't suffer like another concussion during the postseason, especially, he's an important piece for them. Clearly a leader already on this team, but I think he could come through and provide something as well. And I think the other part of this is that it's an opportunity for Corbin Carroll to sort of ascend to superstar status. That's been the best thing about this Diamondbacks team going on a run. And we talked about it maybe last week, is they might be a year or two ahead of schedule, but that's fine. They've got some pieces in place that can absolutely do some damage. Now, the story in game two is Merrill Kelly. And the bigger story with Merrill Kelly, the more you think about it, the more impressive it is, right? This is a guy that spent 4 years in the KBO pitching in Korea, a guy that grew up in Arizona, went to Arizona State, and is now pitching for the home club. And it's just like when he came back from Korea, Merrill Kelly, to me, looked like your prototypical number four, number five starter. Kind of a low fours, mid fours ERA. Maybe the most interesting thing about him at the time was, hey, he's going to chew up a lot of innings. So, your other guys maybe have a little less weight to pull because Merrill Kelly is a good innings-eating back-end starter. And this year, we saw improvement. We saw a strikeout rate that jumped. And given his age, he's 35 years old, that's pretty surprising. He was excellent in game two. And he's one of those guys that I probably wrote him off 3 years ago as far as making an improvement like this. So I was stunned that he put together the regular season he did. And I think the question a lot of people have is, how is this happening for him at such an advanced age? What has made Merrill Kelly so effective this season and in the postseason compared to what he was doing in his first few seasons after he came back stateside?
One thing that I've heard from a fair amount of players that have gone overseas is that their command has improved when they've gone overseas. And there's a slightly weird reasoning for this, but I've heard it from enough pitchers that have gone over and come back, is that the tight zone, the strike zone is tighter for Americans in Japan and Korea. It's like that, we've actually seen this demonstrated in America too. Like there's bias that runs along ethnic backgrounds. There's different biases in American umpires that have been shown. So I'm not saying that this is something that, oh, shame on the NPB for doing this. It's like something that's sort of inherent in umpiring that we've seen in different leagues. But when you were faced with a tighter zone, you have to be able to command to a tighter zone. Like you have to improve your command to live in the NPB. which is the Nippon Professional Baseball, is the Japanese league. So, you know, when you're over in Korea or you're over in Japan, you're faced with a tighter strike zone for whatever reason, you can improve your command. So that's one thing that I've heard from Kelly and from other guys that have come back. The other is that, you know, he's a guy that lives off of having a wide variety of pitches and commanding them well. So, you know, I think his changeup is actually sneaky good, like a really good changeup. And his curveball is top shelf too, but he has to do enough with all three of his fastballs and his three secondaries so that he never gets predictable. And I think playing against lineups in Japan and Korea that are something like AAA or quadruple A, you know, like, you know, getting against sophisticated lineups that are trying to win, as opposed to maybe lineups in the minor leagues here that are all, they're all working on something, you know, they're all trying to just demonstrate that they're ready or whatever it is, you know, working against lineups that are trying to win, you start to be like, oh, I can do this and I can do this and I can, you know, I can play around with my mix. I can do this when they think this. And so that's what I see when I see Kelly, is a guy who can place these pitches at the right time, with good command, has a big mix. For what it's worth, like, I think I'm making sure of this right now, but like a little bit of a velo boost in the postseason. You know, he was sitting 91s and 92s during the season. He's been sitting 93 in the last two starts of the postseason, and that hasn't affected his command in any deleterious way. So, large mix, lots of different fastballs. I wrote a piece last week about the new battle for the top of the zone, which talks about how if you have a four-seamer at the top of the zone, batters are getting better. Marcus Semien, other guys have talked about, you know, you just aim two or three balls above where the ball is supposed to come in, and that's, you get on top of the ball and you use your top hand and you that's how you hit the four seamers, right? So if you have a two seamer and you see that they're hitting your four seamer, then what you do is you throw a high two seamer. And this year in baseball, we saw 3,000 more high two seamers and sinkers than we'd seen before. And so, you know, you could think of that like, oh, it's a high fastball. It's a high hard pitch. That's a fastball. I'm going to aim for the top of it, get my top hand on top of it. Oh, it's dipping. You know, it's a high dipping pitch. And so I had a video of Tommy Pham missing over the top of a high sinker because he thought it was a four-seamer. And there's more of that. So what you've got with Kelly is a guy with three fastballs. So if the hitter sees hard, you know, they'll think maybe hard this way. They'll think, oh, hard four-seamer, hard sinker. Well, they only, you know, Kelly could make it so they only have a third chance of being right. You know, because he could, oh, you thought it was a four-seamer, it was a cutter. Oh, you thought it was a cutter, it was a sinker. You know, so like he can, with three fastballs, he can really play. Hitters just want to be able to say, I'm going to pigeonhole you. If it's hard, it's this. If it's soft, it's this. And he can really play with all those definitions.
Yeah, it's interesting too. You mentioned how good the changeup is. When you pair a great changeup with three different fastballs and you also have two breaking balls that can show up on occasion, whether or not those pitches are even good is more just, you have to think about them, you have to account for them. It's something you can sneak in certain situations at the very least. I think that's what makes me wonder if, you know, is this version of Merrill Kelly, when you look at someone like Lance Lynn, when you say a lot of fastballs, I'm like, oh, Lance Lynn, he's got a million fastballs. He doesn't have the other stuff that Merrill Kelly has.
Kelly has better secondaries than Lance Lynn. But I was like, I definitely thought of Lance Lynn recently. I was thinking of Kelly. I was like, Kelly's like a Lance Lynn with better secondaries.
Right. If you're Lance Lynn, or you're the pitching coaches that work with Lance Lynn in the future, you're probably pointing to Merrill Kelly and saying, look, he's not lighting up the radar gun. He's got some things that you do. You could take some of these approaches and maybe, you know, make a version for yourself.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLBSHOW.
I thought there were some really interesting things about game planning behind the scenes. I saw Andy McCullough had a story about Dan Heron, who worked, his title is a pitching strategist for the Diamondbacks. We know Brent Strom, longtime Astros pitching coach, is the actual pitching coach for the Diamondbacks. There's, of course, a little bit in there about those two working together. Very different philosophies, but making it work, which I think is really interesting. So definitely read Andy's story about that. But you start to think about the level of planning that actually goes into each and every matchup within a game and the difficulties that I think are presented by an extended series in the postseason, like only compounds that. It makes these matchups even more intense because you have to have extra wrinkles or something that the hitter hasn't necessarily seen before.
What are we going to keep in the pocket for game 6 or 7? You know, are we just going to show everything?
You got to be good enough to get there. To get to the second, third, fourth iteration of your game plan. But I thought there were a couple interesting things. There was a great thread from Trevor May on Twitter breaking down how he would pitch to Adolis Garcia with his stuff, which is not saying, here's Brandon Pfaadt and here's how Brandon Pfaadt's going to try and do it in game three. But I thought that was really insightful, just looking at all the different places that Garcia is good, places where he's got some weaknesses and some holes, and how you take your pitch mix and your location strategy and sort of marry all of those things together. And then you start thinking about the other side, right? Trevor's perspective is just the pitching perspective. The hitter has to sort of anticipate all the things a pitcher might do and then react to that or plan for that. And it's just this amazing cat and mouse game that I think is so much more detailed now more than ever. It's always been there, but the amount of information everybody has at their fingertips makes this even more complex than it's ever been.
Yeah, some of my favorite conversations in the clubhouse I've ever had was when Dan Heron was pitching and Zach Greinke was on his team with him. And we would get into three-way conversations. In fact, one of my favorite conversations with Trevor May and Max Scherzer last year about Stuff Plus, or maybe this year. So, you know, there's a little bit of a corollary there. But, you know, one of the things that makes it so difficult is what you're talking about, the hitter anticipating his own scouting report. And so there's this concept in the military called the red team. And the red team is basically trying to scout yourself, is trying to beat yourself. So if you have cybersecurity, the red team is trying to hack into your own stuff. And so you can tell how people might hack into your stuff. And so, or the red team, if you have a base, the red team attacks your base so that you can see how people would do it and what you would do in response. And so I think most teams now have a red team when they're talking about scouting. And so if you're the hitters on a team, the red team comes up to you and goes, this is how we think they're going to attack you, you know, because we have all access to all these true media things. We have we know where your cold zones are. Adolis, this is what they're going to do to you. you know, and you saw that Garcia actually reacted to this. I got some texts about this that were interesting. What was it? Adolis's swing rate in the playoffs before last night was 59%. He swung at 10 of 30 in game one. That's a red team thing.
It's a big difference in approach. It's
That's
a micro
like, hey,
level.
Dude, like they're going to try and pick you apart high in the zone. So if it's high today, don't swing at it at all.
Yeah. Yeah. On that thread that I mentioned from Trevor May, Lance Brusdowski, who we bring up quite a bit on Rates and Barrels for some of the great stuff that he puts out there, basically asked, like, well, when is that actually like a real adjustment? Like, when do you as a pitcher have to change based on a hitter showing something different like that? And this is where there's the desire to have statistically meaningful things that you can lean on. And then there's situations like this where there are not statistically meaningful things that are going to pop up. You have to decide.
Some of the stuff he's making decisions off of are very few pitches too. If you look at the Trevor May thread, you're like, are you making these decisions based on five pitches? I have some of these heat maps. You can actually see the pitches. There's like three pitches on
individual.
Them.
You can see the seams on the ball.
I wouldn't necessarily be like, oh, don't pitch him there. Cause the one time you pitched him there, so he hit a homer, you know, it's like, So that's part of it for sure.
Yeah, just an incredible amount of detail. So check out that thread.
There's also the secondary level of like, okay, so I've determined that high fastballs to Adolis Garcia. That's the blue zone on there. He obviously doesn't like it. I'm going to come in there with some high fastballs because it's blue there. And red team goes over to Garcia and says, hey, you know, maybe they don't have to because Garcia has seen this all year.
Through him. He's like, they're coming.
The high fastballs again, you know. So they tell him either you can anticipate that. Maybe you can do the top hand adjustment and smack one of those out of the park. Or just take those, you know, like just today, just take those. Maybe that's what he did in game one is take those high fastballs. If you have a really good hitter and you're looking at small blue zones, one of these like low and away for Garcia even was just like, it wasn't like all low and away. It was like just the corner was like, if you have these really good hitters that can make adjustments and they know what you're going to do because they've had their red team come in or they just see it. They know what you're going to do. Sometimes it makes sense to do something suboptimal. Mookie Betts, for example, has a weird blue zone, middle, you know? I don't know why. It shows in some of his heat maps. Maybe you throw him a middle fastball, you know, in a 2-0 count.
No, you still don't. That's too far down the suboptimal rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Like there are levels of suboptimal that are clever because they are unexpected, and there are levels of suboptimal that are stupid because it's just too bad of an idea.
Where is the line?
Middle is on the wrong side of that line. Okay. Where exactly the rest of the zones fall, I'm not certain, but yeah, you're not going middle.
High sinkers and high sliders are right there on that line, because if you think about it, like throw a high sinker and you miss a little bit and that's just a ball that dips right into the middle of the zone. Throw a high slider and not really get it high enough and that's just that's a hanger. So yeah, and sometimes, you know, also you like do the scouting report and you're like, ooh, like I was looking at Brandon Pfaadt and he's moved on the rubber and he's starting to throw a sinker, and the move on the rubber, you know, I don't want to get too complicated into it, but it changed the angle of his pitch coming in, the horizontal angle of his pitch. And if you study horizontal angle, you see that, you know, it creates swings in certain places and takes in other places. So I was looking at this and I was like, oh, this opens up the front door sweeper for Brandon Pfaadt, because the way he's standing now, you know, he's going to get more takes on the inside. So what he should do is throw a sweeper at the right-hander's hip and let the movement take it into the zone, and he'll get a bunch of takes. And I was thinking about that in my head, and I was like, he does not throw that pitch very often right now. So as a coach, I come up to Brandon Pfaadt, a rookie who had a 5.7 ERA this year, he's on a good stretch in the postseason. I say, okay, today against Adolis Garcia, I want you to throw a sweeper that's going to hit him, and instead the movement's going to take it into the zone, and you'll get a called strike. It'll be beautiful. It'll be so good. And Brent Vaughn's going to look at me and be like, you want me to aim at Adolis Garcia?
He's a large human on top of all of this.
Who just had like a whole, even in Trevor Bay's thread, he's like, oh yeah, up and in. That's where Brian Abreu was probably aiming. Mm-hmm. so there's like, you're also, that's what I liked about that piece with Heron too. It's like, these are humans, you know, and you have to have some empathy and like some understanding of who they are as people and emotionally. And so you can't just be like, well, the numbers spit out that you got to throw some front door sweepers today, dude. It's like, okay, well, I've thrown like five of them all right. year. So thanks for that scouting report. I'll try a couple today, I guess, in the World Series.
Great time to experiment with things, yeah. Right? So the series, of course, is shifting to Arizona for the next three games. It could end in five. It's possible. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're going at least six. I'm going to stick with my original prediction.
I'm going to game five as a fan.
Yeah, you get to go to game five. Our buddy Chris Welsh is going to game three. So we're going to have a lot of...
game four, if you see Mama.
Might be a guest on the pod next week. That's awesome.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
The matchup in game three, Max Scherzer versus Brandon Pfaadt. Like Levi and Steven talked about it on deck this morning, and the depth of Scherzer's outing in game three, I think, is really important because you don't have an off day until Thursday. Mm-hmm. And if Scherzer goes really short in this game, some of your preferred long options and what is more of a bullpen game, I realize the health of John Gray and that he's back kind of changes some things a little bit. It could hurt you in a pretty big way in game four, just based on your kind of starting rotation construction as it is right now. So we've talked about Scherzer a couple of times already in this postseason. What's your game plan if you're the Diamondbacks looking at Scherzer and the struggles he's had? Like, how do you make life difficult for him on top of the possibility that he could make life difficult for himself?
He has not had his breaking balls since he came back from injury. And this is something that shows up in, you know, I've got a stat stuff plus that looks at the shapes and the velos of it. But also, if you just watch, he can't locate them. And he's had a really, really hard time locating his slider in the zone. And that's what makes Max Scherzer so great, is he has good fastballs and he has good breaking balls, and you don't know what count you're going to get either in. But if he can't throw a 2-0 slider in the zone, you know, and he's always had like four breaking balls and great touch on four breaking balls. If he doesn't have that, then he's going to have to go to the fastball in fastball counts. And he's going to have to go to the fastball when he needs a strike, and he becomes much more predictable. So I think I would just sit fastball. I would take a very conventional approach. You know, we just talked about like how crazy we can get in the head. I think this one would be like, I'm seeing dead red until he proves to me that he can throw a slider in the zone when he needs a strike, because he has not shown that ability since he came back from injury.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense based on how things have played out for him so far in this postseason. You talked about Fott with the adjustment to the other side of the rubber, and this goes back to about August. He's pitched a lot better since then, right? The regular season numbers, the ERA was close to six, but if you kind of slice it from August 10th forward when he started making those changes, he's been a pretty different pitcher during that time. You know, what do you think the Rangers are trying to do to make Fott uncomfortable? Because this is a lineup that it's just like the problems Fott had to solve against Philly, and maybe even a little more challenging in some ways at the very bottom, where some of those bottom hitters for the Rangers are a tick above the bottom hitters he was facing in the NLCS against the Phillies.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that he's continued to do, so, you know, in August, he went down to the minor leagues. And I just wanted to say, like, really quickly, you've got a bunch of players here who've benefited from a reset on these teams. We're talking about Alec Thomas. He was a better player when he came back from the minor leagues. Brandon Fott went down to the minor leagues, came back up with a new release point. And then over time started actually throwing the sinker more. So there's the release point that happened after he came back, you know, in July. But then he started throwing the sinker a lot more in September. And if you look at his splits, Fott, you know, after he started doing both, you know, throwing from that that new position and then also, you know, throwing the sinker, you know, his strikeout rate was pretty decent. And he's been a great pitcher in the postseason with those things. So, I think that there's just, you know, there's some scouting reports that people have that are old. And then you just don't have, because you don't want to, you're like, oh, well, I don't want to be looking at this heat map where it has three pitches on it. But if you look at Brandon Fott before the move on the rubber, that's not useful. And then if you don't look at him when he's been using the sinker as much as he's used, that's not useful. So you really only have like September and October to look at. And if you're trying to like be like, oh, well, I'm a right-hander, then you're cutting that in half. So you're really only looking at like 300, 400 pitches from him, and then you're cutting it into pitch types, you know, and you're like, and you're cutting it to zones. Like, people are looking at things where they're like, they're looking at these heat maps, so there's three or four pitches, you know, where they need to look. And I think, you know, I don't know what to do in this case. I think every team should have a young guy that's like pretty good that has made a recent adjustment that nobody's seen ready for the playoffs, you know. I don't even know how good Brandon Fott's going to be next year, but right now he's doing stuff that nobody has really that great advanced intel on. The sample sizes aren't great, and so what would I tell a hitter is maybe see ball, hit ball. You know, people have been aggressive against him and people have been passive against him, and neither one has really worked. He's been really good at sort of tweaking small things and getting the most out of whatever approach the hitters are doing against him. The Phillies tried both. They were aggressive and patient against him, and neither one really worked that well.
Do you think there's any situation outside of a massive lead where Fott gets more than the 18, 19, 20 batters? So we've seen the pretty quick hook. I mean, the only reason I'm even thinking it's possible they'd push him a little is if he is holding a two or three run lead or something. Yeah, first in 3 days could force things to be different. But similar to the problems you have at the top of the Phillies lineup, you know, the matchup with Bryce Harper in the NLCS is kind of like what he's got with Corey Seager in this series, where it's like Brandon Fott versus Corey Seager. If he finds a way to not get destroyed by him the first two times, you really don't want to tempt fate and give Corey Seager a third look at him.
Yeah, like if you watch the Phillies series, like Fott against the lefties was not comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, like every at bat between Fott and Schwarber was like nine pitches. You know, and it was all just like, ooh, I was just trying to dance around the nitro zone, trying to throw weird pitches, throwing sweepers, you know, to lefties. You shouldn't do that, but like, you just got to keep Schwarber guessing, you know. And at one time, he even got Schwarber, I think, on a high four seam fastball, which is like Schwarber's, that was the pitch that Schwarber, like, couldn't hit for a long time, but then figured out how to hit. Like, he was getting, he got Schwarber, he was throwing low sinkers to Schwarber, which is like, you know, you just had to like do crazy stuff because he had to figure out a way to get those guys out. And Schwarber and Harper, the lefties, were the hard ones for him. Even with a good changeup that Fott has, it's hard. You don't want to throw a sinker to them. You know, your four seam's not that great. You know, you don't want to throw the sweeper to them. You're just kind of like, I can't just throw only changeups to these guys. I got to throw something else. So, yeah, the Seager thing, I think the third time Seager's up is when Fott is out. And I know that people will roll their eyes and be like, oh, analytics taking over the game. And, you know, this is a problem. And, you know, if Fott is dealing, he should be left in. And, you know, I get all that. And in fact, you know, there are some analytical arguments that, you know, teams can get into trouble taking their stars out early. One, relievers are worse every pitch they throw over the course of the season. That's been shown. Two, relievers are worse on back-to-back days and back-to-back-to-back days. That's been shown. Their velo is down. Their command is down. Three, and this is just out in the Saber Journal. This is newest research, is over the course of a series, the more times you see a reliever, the better you get at them. And that effect is bigger than the third time through the order penalty. It's like a really big thing. So, you know, every time you run Ryan Thompson out there, the first time is going to be good. The second time, if it's in a back-to-back, it's going to be worse. And if it's third time, it's a back-to-back-to-back, and the same hitters have seen him 3 days in a row, somebody's going to get to him. So if there is some sort of lead, I would passionately argue for leaving Brandon Fott in and not giving the opponents more looks at my relievers that I only have a few that I trust anyway.
And I think the threshold for me is a 3-run lead. If you're up 3 and you get to that point where he's starting to see the lineup a third time, there's no one on base,
you could just walk Seager.
Let it go. Yeah, like, let's see what happens. As soon as there's trouble, then play the matchups, go to your bullpen. But he may be able to navigate some of the bumps the third time through if everything is working, if the strategy is good enough to work against these hitters. I think the key difference for me, though, too, when you think about NLCS versus World Series and these matchups, and instead of being Schwarber and Harper, it's Evan Carter as the other guy with Corey Seager as the lefties up top, right? And I think Evan Carter is a fantastic player. He doesn't have the experience that Schwarber does, and I don't feel, even though Carter can do damage, I don't feel like a mistake to Evan stuff. Carter is quite as likely to end up 450 feet away, even though, again, Evan Carter is a very good young player. So it could be a slightly easier combination of matchups, but I would also say the righties are going to be a problem too. I'm also interested to see Marcus Semien. Is he going to get going in this series? It seems like it's inevitable because Marcus Semien's been such a great player since the Rangers signed him. There was that brief lull first, like 6 weeks into year one, where he was struggling, and he's been fantastic in the time since then. Can he get right here mid-series?
Yeah, what's his postseason line? It's been a whole problem in the postseason. 194, 265, 226 in the postseason, and that's in 68 plate appearances. That would be a bad month. Do you remember, what was the year that he had it was last year when he signed the contract, and, you know, he was like one of the worst regulars for the first month of the season. And we had a long conversation about that once, and you know, I don't want to give, I'm not like in the business of excuses necessarily, but I think as an explanation, changing teams, not being able to work out in a team facility, and, you know, moving his whole family and his kids to a new situation. And he explained that, like, he was, you know, trying to be awake to send the kids to school at like 6 or 7 a.m, you know, after, you know, playing till midnight 1 or whatever, you know, like after being awake then, you know, the night before, and trying to, you know, put naps in there. But it sounded exhausting just listening to it. And I think that was a big explanation. And as a guy who's played so many plate appearances, you know, he's just one of these post-to-post everyday guys. I wonder if there is any fatigue in him right now. The bat speed doesn't necessarily look all the way there. He's making contact, but there's no power behind it. And he also made like a couple of mistakes in the field that I was like kind of just really surprised. It just looked like sort of concentration errors. I wonder if he's tired. I mean, I just, you know, probably everyone's tired, but I wonder if somehow, you know, all those plate appearances for him have added up to a little bit more fatigue than some of the other guys out there.
You go back through the last three regular seasons, there's no player in Major League Baseball with more plate appearances than Marcus Semien. 2,201 in the regular season, tack on the postseason this year on top of that. He just doesn't take days off. Totally a fair question to wonder if fatigue is starting to set in here for him as we near the very end of October. Quickly looking ahead just to game four, in theory, it's going to be some combination of probably Heaney, Dunning, Gray. We'll see what they decide to do based on what happens in game three versus what I assume to be an Arizona bullpen that did the job in game four of the NLCS when they used eight pitchers. Right? That was the game that Joe Manaply started. We saw Luis Frias, Kyle Nelson, Miguel Castro, Andrew Salfrank.
Who were the guys that did two innings? Thompson?
I think it was Thompson. Salfrank can usually give them more than one if they need it.
Yeah, but he's got the command is so minus.
I just wonder like how much can you follow that same script, right? You want to follow that script again, but you...
But that was, they seemed fairly lucky at the time that it all worked out.
Yeah, you kind of just flirted with disaster and got away with it in a pretty difficult spot. I don't know if that can work twice against top-level lineups.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe they'll have to use some Ryan Nelson for some length. Which is living on the edge, given the results. But one thing that Ryan Nelson does have is a fastball with an interesting profile. So if you're not asking him to turn the lineup over, in which case he can't keep throwing that same fastball, you know. But if you just ask him to turn the lineup over once, which is two innings, you know, two or three innings, then I think he could do that. So. I'm guessing we're going to see Nelson in there just because they need more length. And, you know, you just, if the score turns, you know, they might go to Ryan Nelson for four or five because they got to protect that bullpen because there's the next game, you know?
Right. If you have any issues with Gallen or if you want to make sure you have everybody that you like available for game five, it's part of what makes the playoff baseball so challenging, just making sure you've got the right guys available for the right spots, and you don't always know what's behind door number two or what's going to happen in the next inning, but that's just the difficulty of managing the game. Looking back, it was Frias for 1 1/3, Castro for 1 2/3, Thompson for 2. Those were the only three pitchers that got more than three outs for the Diamondbacks in that bullpen game in the last round, so something similar seems very likely for them in game four, and you kind of return to your game one matchup, Gallen versus Montgomery for game five. So a lot there to like, or Gallen versus Evaldi, right? That's the game one matchup. So nice to see that one coming back around in game five. It's a great pitching matchup for you since you're going to be on hand for that one.
Oh yeah, that'll be fun. I'll be in the stands with Paul Spohr, who I've done podcasts with in the past from over at Fangraphs. So that'll be fun. And then into that weekend, the Arizona Fall League All-Star Game, which is always a crazy transition to go from like the World Series with, you know, they're selling standing room only tickets, and tickets are pretty expensive, and it's like, I think it's going to be pretty wild. Like Tuesday night when my mom's going, it's going to be Halloween, you know, so that's going to be pretty wild. And, you know, then the Arizona Fall League is like, you know, there might be 50 people in the stands for a game.
Yeah, for the regular game. 30 people show up for Fall Stars at least. Like Sunday night is the Fall Stars game. For anyone who's not familiar, they televise it on MLB Network. So if you're not going to be in Arizona, you can at least watch it. A lot of prospects that appear in that game end up playing in the big leagues the following season. So you and I will be there as part of a fantasy baseball conference. So Beyond the Athletic Baseball Show, we've got a Rates and Barrels that'll come out on Tuesday. So if you're already thinking about next season, we have you covered there, and we're going to have an episode that we record while we're in Arizona as well. As for this show, we are signing off for today, but the Athletic Baseball Show returns on Tuesday.
Always got the green light here.
Green light 3-0, and she's gone!
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.